Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Thank you for joining us today on New Books Network. Today I have Dr. Michael Ramirez, an associate professor of sociology at Texas A&M University Corpus Christi. He earned his PhD and MA in sociology from the University of Georgia, and he earned his Bachelor of Arts degree in sociology from Texas Tech University. His area of expertise include class, race, and gender, with a particular emphasis on men and masculinities, work, identity, aging, and life course, and qualitative methods. His first book that we'll be talking about today on New Books in Sociology is titled Destined for Greatness, Passions, Dreams, and Aspirations in the College Music Town, particularly focused on the music town of Georgia, and it was published just this year by Rutgers University Press. In this book, he examines men and women pursuing informal careers in music as they move into adulthood. Some of his other work has been published in Symbolic Interaction, Journal of Men's Studies, Journal of Adolescent Research, Qualitative Sociology Review, among many other outlets. I look forward to talking to him today, and thank you, Dr. Ramirez, for being with us today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Can you tell me a little bit maybe more about yourself and how you came upon this study?
Sure. I guess the most direct answer to this, as it can be, is that I've always loved music. I know everyone out there, you know, pretty much loves music, but I kind of feel like that's like a big component that led to the study of this music world. And as I was making my way through not just undergraduate, but especially through my graduate program, I really started to appreciate what a lot of sociologists refer to as sociology of the everyday, and just studying those everyday aspects of life that a lot of times we don't really think about or question or analyze. And when I moved to Athens to start the graduate program at the University of Georgia, I was excited that there's a music culture there. And, you know, like I said, I'd always loved music, and, you know, kind of like a lot of teen boys and teen girls, you know, I played the guitar when I was younger, and, you know, I'd kind of played around with little rock bands and that sort of thing, but I'd never really thought about pursuing music, and I never really had it in me to even consider that as an option. But once I moved to Athens and I saw all these bands just playing every night, and there's all these venues, and, you know, just the history of Athens with REM and, you know, just the slew of other bands, it was hard for me to not view that and not think about that sociologically. So the more time that I spent there and the more time that I spent in the sociology program, I just started to think that there was something ripe for sociological investigation. And so I started kind of thinking about it and thinking about what sort of questions I could ask. And, you know, of course, exploring other sociology of music studies. And, you know, there's so much great work out there, and, you know, I kind of gobbled all that up. LeBlanc's Pretty in Punk, I mean, that's one of my favorite books in the sociology of music. And Ross Handler's Straight Edge. Some of the work that Claussen did on When Women Play the Bass. Grazian's Blue Chicago. Yeah, I mean, they're just book after book after book that I just I loved. I thought it was really informative in terms of how music matters and how it really does inform us about these social issues beyond just those musical worlds. And then especially when William Bilby gave his ASA presidential address, and it was called Rockin' a Hard Place. And that, it just really solidified a lot of what I was thinking and a lot of what I was kind of conceptualizing in terms of these questions about music and musical pursuits. So I was, again, just kind of on the side, just reading all these books and all this work in the sociology of music, because at that point, I don't think it was that really mainstream. I know there's a lot of cultural studies on music and a lot of, some social psychological work on music, and of course some gender focused work on music, but there wasn't really like this coherent like sub area in sociology focused on music. So it was kind of, a little challenging, I guess, for me to kind of navigate what particular question, especially what particular frame I was going to use to do this potential study on musicians. But I clearly remember, actually, I forgot about this initially, but then a few years ago, this memory kind of came back to me. But I remember I was taking a gender course at UGA, and one of our readings was Kathleen Gerson's Hard Choices, which has nothing to do with music. You know, it's about work-family conflict, and it's about how women basically make choices in terms of their working lives and their family lives. And I absolutely fell in love with that book. And probably to this day, if I had to choose my single most favorite sociology book, it would probably be Hard Choices. And one thing that I especially appreciated about her book was just the frame that she used. And it was very much this retrospective life course frame that she used to understand these women's lives. And so that always kind of stuck with me. And as I was thinking about musicians, I thought that could be the perfect way to analyze their lives, is to interview them, at this point in their lives, but also ask them about beginnings and kind of ask them about how it is that they see and kind of make sense of how they ended up where they ended up in terms of their current lives. So, very much a symbolic interactionist perspective. But I feel like I really owe a lot to Gerson's book and to that framework, because I don't know if I would have done the research that I'd done and written the book that I did were it not for her work, and of course the work of other sociologists as well. But it just kind of started like that. I just loved music, and I think like a lot of sociologists, we can't really turn the sociology off ever. And even these personal interests or these things that we kind of live or experience or see in our day-to-day lives has important sociological kind of implications and significance to it. So that's kind of how it started. And of course the book is focused on music culture and careers, and in a lot of ways it's really looking at aging and how that matters in these music worlds. And I think early on I was interested in how it is that, because like I said, I love music, and I've been in a ton of pretty terrible bands myself, but I've never had that experience where I thought, this is what I want to do. Like, I want to pursue music. I want to, go full force with pursuing this career in music, because to me that would be the scariest decision I could ever make, because it's such a precarious line of work, and it's so competitive, and it would just, to me, it would just be more stress than I could ever think I could tolerate. But I was curious, like, how is it that people make these, quote, irrational choices to pursue music? Because that's how a lot of the musicians framed it, is that, their families and, their partners and their friends and other people in their lives really, thought they were making the wrong choice, and that they weren't being rational in terms of thinking about their futures and about their adulthoods and that sort of thing. So I was kind of,
if I remember right, it was females most often received that because their expectation was to have children at that point in their life, and many of them were focusing on their music career.
Right. Yeah, I think that it was kind of a unique sample because there was not a, well, I think there was just a handful, and I remember one in particular musician that actually did have a child, but for a lot of them, that was kind of the one of the critical points is that I don't have children, you know, I have a family. So, you know, I'm not like, you know, quote, stealing, you know, money from their mouths or, you know, food from their mouths or that sort of thing. But that kind of what they would frame as a pseudo selfish decision wasn't negatively impacting their families' lives because most of them didn't have families. So yeah, that was kind of one way that they navigated that particular issue. And it was far easier, I think, for men to kind of reconcile those issues compared to women, because there were some women that were kind of up in the air in terms of what they thought their futures held, and especially in terms of their family lives. Whereas there were some men that thought, I don't think that I'm going to have children, or, you know, I don't think that would really impact my work life or, you know, my music life. So yeah, that was very much a gendered component of the way that they would kind of navigate that decision, certainly.
And then the other piece that I appreciated most about the book is how you took an approach from early on in life and showing how those fundamental years of childhood and the class of the family was crucial to the development of their music into college years.
Oh, right. Absolutely. Yeah. From day one, it felt like, class and, you know, just how that was embedded in their family really did, set the tone for what was to come next. For the most part, it was a heavily middle-class sample, that I, included, or that I was able to recruit for this book. And that mattered. I mean, that certainly mattered in terms of how it was that music became an option for them, you know, and just the opportunities that arose due to that, certainly.
And the participants who were college students but didn't necessarily come to Athens, Georgia for college, using that basically as a backdrop for their music career, and potentially using that as an option in case music didn't work out for them.
Right. And that was, it was interesting just to see how the, you know, the locale of Athens mattered, because for a good deal of them, I think there were kind of two different things that were going on with part of the sample, and some of them went to UGA and enrolled in UGA just because, you know, partly because it was the flagship university of Georgia, and, you know, their parents had gone there and grandparents had gone there, and, you know, good reputation and that sort of thing. And for some of them, it wasn't until they arrived in Athens and kind of discovered that world of music, even if they had participated in music earlier in life, that option really opened up to them. And they realized that they could easily fit music into their college lives, because, you know, they were still, I mean, of course, you know, for these students and for these musicians during that time in life, they were adults, but they still had a lot of kind of leeway and flexibility in their day-to-day lives. So it was very easy for them to be successful college students and to do well and earn good grades and, you know, do everything that they need to do to keep their parents happy, but still do music on the side. So there's very little tension during those years, you know, during those emerging adult years, where they could pull it off. I mean, they could pull it off fairly easily, just kind of navigating both of those identities, being a college student and also being a musician. And a lot of their parents actually were, they took pride in that, because it wasn't something that they necessarily hid from their parents. But their parents were just impressed or just kind of proud that, oh, my son or my daughter is basically a college student by day and a musician by night, and, you know, does well in his or her classes. And then on weekends, you know, does this band thing, and they have the CD coming out. You know, so there was this, you know, very much this pride and the support that they had from their parents early in life. Whereas another portion of the sample who moved specifically to Athens because it's such an iconic music town. You know, there's a lot more writing on that decision where some of them moved from as far away as Michigan, and, you know, sometimes from Florida, which wasn't quite as far away. But then some from Utah, but they just trekked far, far away from home to make Athens their home because they knew just the reputation that the town had, and they knew there are certain bands that they knew. Sometimes bands had toured through their hometowns, and they'd met them, kind of befriended them, and there was just this pull in terms of Athens, great, you know, Athens a very supportive music town. You know, you should absolutely move if you have that kind of passion that's in your blood, or, you know, that you're kind of interested in pursuing yourself. And for those, it was, you know, there was a lot more writing on it because they were moving specifically to build their musical careers and their dreams on that dramatic change, and just, you know, packing up and moving and, you know, locating to a new town where they didn't know anyone, didn't really know anything about the town other than bands that stemmed from that town. So it was more precarious for them, but it was still very much a risk that they were willing to take. Things became different once the musician aged out of those emerging adult years, and especially after age like 25, 26 or so, it was more difficult for them to kind of navigate those musical decisions that they were committing to. But at least early on, during those early adult years, it was pretty easy for them to balance both of those aspects of their lives.
And did you see males being more risk-taking than what the females were? Or did you see any gendered observations in that area?
It did seem like there was, a little bit more, at least in the stories that I was hearing and the narratives that I was getting from the women and men. Part of it was that men were, like, everything was riding on this. Like this is what they were destined to do, you know, this is what they were put on this earth to do. They were artists, they were musicians. Like for some of the men, they said, this isn't really a choice. Like this is like a virus that I have, you know, and I'm just compelled to do it. Like, even if I try to fight it, I can't fight it, but this is what I'm going to do. This is what I have to do. For some of them, it was kind of framed as maybe this risk-taking behavior where, you know, like, if I don't do it now, for some of them, it was just a now or never behavior. If I don't do this now, I'm never going to have a chance to do it, you know. And right now, I can afford to do this because right now I'm in my early 20s, and, you know, right now I don't have a family, and right now, you know, me myself, I can scrape by with little income and that sort of thing. But yeah, for the women, there was a somewhat different story. They were still very much, committed to music. And they, you know, they still, you know, talked about how they felt it in their blood. But they were more apprehensive in some ways, just because partly because they felt like imposters, you know. That was just very much a recurring theme, is that they didn't always feel like they, completely, belonged in that world. And again, it's just due to the gendered makeup of it, and how it would still continue to be this gender dominated field. And, you know, rock is still kind of framed as this masculine heavy subculture, I guess. And I think that's one thing that gave them a little hesitation, coupled with the fact that or at least some of the women that I interviewed had less of a history in terms of their participation in bands and even like the longevity that they had had in terms of learning or mastering their instruments. So they kind of felt like frauds, and you know, they kind of felt like they were imposters, and that's something that that kind of seemed to impact their commitment, or you know, just this idea that that everything was going to ride on you know, pinning all their dreams to music and kind of making it in the world. And then the other thing in terms of women was tied to their aging identities and how a lot of them almost felt it was not inappropriate per se, but just a little bit kind of outside the parameters in terms of older women pursuing music. Like there's a lot of them half jokingly, but still I think half truthfully would say things like, well, how cool would it be for me to be up on stage as a 40-year-old woman or a 50-year-old woman? And there weren't any men that ever said that, like, oh, I'm going to age out of here. Although they did have these tensions of aging, but they never felt like this is going to be too juvenile for me to do when I'm in my 30s, 40s, 50s, etc. But for women, it was almost this idea that an adult femininity was incompatible with this musician identity. So yeah, I think there was a lot of different pieces, or just a lot of different kind of effects that were coming into play in women's lives that was that tended to give them at the very least hesitation as to whether they should or could pursue this for the entirety of their lives.
And it could be associated to, as you mentioned in your book, early on in life, parents were less reluctant to allow their young boys to move from the piano or keyboard to the guitar, whereas young girls would stay with the piano for many more years.
Right. Absolutely. And that was kind of one of the surprising findings in the interviews is that, of course, I asked them just their musical history in terms of instrumentation, and a vast majority of them, both men and women, did talk about how the piano was their first instrument. And a lot of them, it wasn't necessarily by choice, but a lot of them, it was almost like this middle class, like some of them even said, it's just what happened when you came of age in my family. You know, once you turned 8 or 10 or X years old, my parents enrolled us in piano, and you know, it wasn't really a choice, but it was just kind of a norm in the family. But that was something that was pretty standardized or pretty consistent in both the men and women's younger lives or younger experiences. But then, yeah, it was interesting to see how the men in particular, they were not a fan of it. You know, they weren't generally interested or crazy about or committed to the piano. Sometimes, you know, after a couple of months or a year or so, they would abandon the piano if they could. And then strategically, some of them realized, because they would try to negotiate, like, Mom and Dad, I really want a guitar. You know, I really want a drum set. And part of that negotiation was, well, stick with the piano. Like, we want to see if you kind of have this music talent in you to begin with, and we want to see some sort of commitment in terms of you sticking it out with the piano. And then, you know, in a year or in 2 years from now, we'll talk about this guitar thing. You know, we'll talk about this rock and roll thing. So for some of the men, it was just this strategic, like, all right, I just got to kind of grin and bear it. You know, commit to the piano because I know that it's going to pay off in terms of me being able to get the instrument that I really want, which is the guitar. Whereas for women, there was less of that negotiation. And for women, there was, it seemed that there was a longer tenure that they had taking piano lessons and, you know, just kind of committing to the piano for a longer span of time than did the men. And that kind of worked, I wouldn't really say to their advantage later in life, but that did help them once they got to the early adult years, that did help them to kind of use that as a avenue into bands, because they could, since they had so many years of experience on the piano, they could easily transition that to being the keyboardist for the band and, you know, learning other instruments for the band. But yeah, generally I didn't see that that the women would negotiate for a guitar. And even when they loved music, because, you know, the women certainly loved rock as much as the men did. So it's not that men were bigger fans or more devoted fans, or, you know, that they were just like innately, you know, more drawn to rock than women were. But it was just, you know, just issues in terms of, I think, masculinity and femininity, and just kind of the give and take that they got from their parents, and, you know, the willingness that their parents did or didn't have for them to explore other and especially louder instruments. You know, a lot of the musicians talked about how, you know, playing the piano, like, it's a nice kind of soft, you know, classical kind of high status instrument, but, you know, bringing a guitar into the home, or, you know, God forbid, a drum set into the home, like, that's something that a lot of parents just didn't want to deal with, just in terms of, you know, just the ruckus that was going to make. But yeah, really interesting in terms of how, you know, perhaps due to socialization, you know, perhaps due to the ways that, you know, these boys and girls were learning masculinity and femininity, they were kind of even just considering and approaching their parents with the prospective idea of learning new instruments, and especially rock instruments. You know, that was something that of course it was going to hinder women's musical careers later on, because they had less time in which they were invested in those rock instruments. You know, the women that later on in life eventually did get a guitar, start learning the guitar or drums or bass or whatever the instrument may have been. A lot of them tended to have a shorter span of years in which they had practiced on that particular instrument. And for a lot of women, they felt like they hadn't mastered that instrument. And I think that does lead back to that imposter status that a lot of them felt, is that, you know, they'd say, and I can kind of get that. I mean, you know, with the interviews with those boys that at age 12, 13, 14, when they got their first guitars, you know, they had like a 7, 8, 9 year head start to just kind of noodle around on their guitars and kind of figure out that instrument before they joined a serious band in adulthood when they were in Athens, versus the women, if they didn't get their first guitar or actively start learning rock instruments until the post high school years, to them it was just more of a, it was more intimidating to know, all right, I've only been playing this instrument for a year or 2 years, and now do I really think I can be in a band? Like, do I really think that I'm good enough and I've mastered this instrument enough to really make it in a quote real band? And then I think probably one of the most surprising things that I found in some of these interviews, and there's even some quotes in the book that kind of capture my surprise. But it's whenever I ask a couple of the women how many bands they've been in before their current band. And there were a handful of women that said, this is my first band. You know, this is the first band and the only band I've ever been in. And I was just shocked, because these were women who were in bands that had toured nationally. You know, they had one plus records out. You know, they were, you know, they had a pseudo or a semi-national following. Like, they had made it kind of big, you know, for this being their first band. And even more surprisingly than that was the reality that a lot of them shared with me, that once they joined their first band is when they started learning their first instrument. So it was just doubly shocking. Yeah. I mean, I literally said, wow, a number of times during these interviews. And you know, part of that was just tied to how they were invited to these bands. And a lot of times it's when they were in dating relationships with other musicians. And sometimes their boyfriends would throw out the idea, you know what, we should start a band. You know what, you should learn the bass and we should start a new band. And they would do it. But again, you know, just that that hesitation, or just that idea that, yeah, I'm all in. I'm going to go for it. But, you know, when reality set in, all right, I'm joining this band. You know, my boyfriend who I'm joining this band with has done this for 10 plus years. Like, he knows what he's doing, versus me. Like, I'm just kind of, you know, stumbling my way through figuring out the bass. Typically was the bass or sometimes the keyboards that they started on. You know, it was just a world of difference in terms of, you know, just kind of their self-defined expertise, and even beyond that, just the comfort that they had with their instruments. And I really think that's something that dramatically set the stage for these women and men, in some cases differentially being comfortable in the music world and the extent to which they imagined that they could pursue that for the entirety of their lives.
And linking back possibly to the foundational years in their lives when young boys idolize and want to be like the musicians. That's something that I remember fondly from your book, and how the girls viewed the major musicians as not somebody they want to be like, but someone they might adore or want to date.
Right. Yeah. And that's something that I know that there's been other work that's kind of examined that disjuncture between men and women, boys and girls, and, you know, just their experiences of fandom. Like when men see rock stars, they want to be the rock stars. And when girls see rock stars, they want to date the rock stars. So there was a little bit of that I heard from the men and women that I interviewed, and especially the men. I think that they could easily look at their favorite rock stars as they were growing up and just kind of fantasize and just kind of imagine themselves being that, you know. And whether it was, you know, Nirvana, you know, a lot of them, of course, talk about Nirvana and, you know, grunge bands that they grew up on. But even if it was more, even if it was Kiss, you know, like some of them did say, yeah, even Kiss, like up there with their faces painted and these platform boots and kind of these cartoonish identities that they adopted, like they could still kind of see themselves doing that. Or the David Bowies, you know, like these other kind of gender bender rock icons, where, you know, they could still kind of see themselves fitting into that mold, or, you know, kind of performing the way that they did. Whereas some of the women that I interviewed, sometimes they were fans of, I don't even think it really mattered whether they were fans of bands that were comprised of women, men, or both. But I think even whenever they were following bands that had women as singers or instrumentalists, I don't think that even that alone kind of pushed them to really see themselves as kind of seeing music as in the realm of their possibility. I think it may have prompted some of them, but even just more important than that was just this idea that rock was still just oozing with masculinity. Like, it was still very much a boy's world and a man's world. That, you know, I think that was one of the more powerful kind of obstacles, I guess, that women needed to, not even that they needed to overcome, but, you know, just this shift in terms of what they saw versus how they imagined that they could fit into that. But yeah, certainly the men, you know, like, they would clearly and easily talk about the music that they'd listen to. And, you know, it wasn't too big of a stretch for them to imagine themselves doing the same things.
And then the other interesting piece is about their mothers and fathers, and about how mothers and fathers who were divorced, or when you had them separated, fathers would tend to sort of stand back and want to be like their children, who are great musicians, but they've never found themselves as being as good, not spending as much time with their instrument, and sort of being cheerleaders on the sideline, whereas the mothers tended to be more reluctant to allow their child to continue on with such a career.
Mm-hmm. Right. And even early in life, it was interesting to see how, of course, both parents played a role in the children's musical development. But it was interesting to start to see these trends in terms of the specific role that fathers played versus the roles that moms or that mothers tended to play. And a lot of the musicians, whenever they were talking or speaking about their early years in life, they would talk about how just some of their earliest memories were just infused with music. And, you know, they can remember taking road trips with their families and, you know, the rock station would be on and, you know, they'd listen to whatever, like the Cars or, you know, the Police or, you know, whatever bands their parents were listening to. But a lot of them said, really, it's when I was at home, that's when I realized what this kind of differential influence that I had from mom and dad tended to be. So dads tended to be just the kind of like stereotypically like the hardcore like rock music fans. Like their dads loved music, loved rock, loved going to concerts. You know, they'd always be blasting rock music. You know, they'd talk about how Saturdays would be the days that we'd just open up all the windows. You know, we'd clean our house and, you know, we'd just have the stereo turned up to 11, you know, just listening to rock, you know, because dad would turn the music up really loud. Yes. So dads loved music, but dads tended not to actually play music. And it was, I think, kind of rare for the musicians to have fathers that played the guitar. Sometimes they had guitars laying around, but they weren't really well versed in the guitar, really, and any instrument for that matter, versus whenever they would talk about their moms, they tended to talk about how the moms were more artistic and musical. And they had moms that were, that would practice just the craft of their music or of their art. You know, they had moms that played guitar or that were in folk bands or that were DJs for their college radio station. Or there was one that had a mother who was an opera singer and others that talked about their moms being, part of the church choir, that sort of thing. So it's kind of almost surprising, you know, just that, you know, dads loved music. Dads were the consummate music and rock fans, but it was the moms that tended to actually have that training or that art or that performative aspect in terms of music. So it's kind of interesting to just kind of see that comparison and just hear that comparison from the musicians, and then, you know, how that kind of adapted as they grew older and as the musician moved into the adult years, and how there was these, again, just kind of these different pushes and pulls that they got from mom and dad once they were in college, and especially the post-college years, in terms of you know, kind of the gendered advice they got in terms of you know, whether it was a good idea, you know, whether there was that support that the parents would lend to their children pursuing music. And there's a lot of fathers that would talk about, they would almost directly say, and in some cases they would directly say to their sons, you're an adult, like, when are you going to get over this music thing? You need to get a damn job. Like, I'm not going to give you a damn penny. So it was very much like, all right, this is fine. You know, this is fine when you're a teen, this is fine when you're in college, but now you're an adult man. You need to basically act like it, you know, put this music.
Or the relative who was a doctor and said, what are you going to do? And he felt that he didn't need to justify it and said, this is what I'm doing.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. And some of them were able to do it because, again, just this now or never behavior. This is the time that I can do it. This is time when I really don't have any major responsibilities. And the musicians didn't feel like it was putting them off time. Their parents and, you know, their family members certainly didn't see it that same way, but they felt like this is the right time to do it. And my time might be limited, you know, like I might have a very short timeline that I can devote myself to music and this possibility of music. But yeah, you know, that was something that seemed to be somewhat gendered as well.
And then you really didn't take this approach in your book, but do you think that this might be a possibility of the millennial attitude? And maybe you'll find something different with the new Generation Z, or maybe an earlier generation, if you were to have done the study with the baby boomers when they are of this age?
I think so. Yeah, I do think there's something generationally important and particular that's going on with this sample and with this cohort. Because even some of the lit which I reviewed, and I think in the conclusion I talk about how in a lot of ways, really, when we get down to it, these musicians aren't failing adulthood. Like, it's not like they're not attaining this adult status, because they're still, every single one of them have moved outside the family home of residence. Every single one of them are supporting themselves. Every single one of them just have this independent, self-sufficient life. And that is very much the core of adulthood, and they're all attaining it, and they're all, pursuing their passion. You know, I think that that's something that we're starting to see generationally. I see it in my students, and I know that there's other work out there, national studies that have shown how seems to be more younger men and women that are really pursuing their passion versus pursuing a paycheck in terms of what they want to spend their lives doing. I think pursuing music is one avenue that illustrates that, but I do think that we see this across the board today, where there's a lot of men and women that are deciding and kind of managing their careers, or managing their possible careers, in terms of thinking, what's going to satisfy me, and what am I going to feel, is my calling, those sorts of things, beyond just the paycheck, or beyond just the idea of strategically choosing a major with a particular career with a particular salary in mind. So I do think there's something kind of generalizable about this sample, even though they're unique, because they really are playing the odds, and they, in some ways, they are making a big gamble by contemplating this decision, or contemplating this career pursuit focused on music. But I really do think that there's something almost, maybe not universal, but there is something generalizable in terms of their non-musical peers today. And certainly, I think that it would have been different, generation or two ago.
Almost a Marxian pushback, almost a sense of revolutionizing and saying, we're not going to accept status quo. Let's go out on a limb and try something different.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Excellent. So you're in Texas now. There's a couple music cities in the state of Texas, like Austin. Have you thought about continuing on with your work and seeing how different music towns look?
A little bit, for a while, and I'm originally from Texas, as you mentioned. So after I was done with graduate school in Georgia, I was happy to come back to Texas, and I did start thinking about maybe doing a comparative study where I could look at a different college music town, or like a bigger music city like Austin, since there's so much musical activity going on there, not just in terms of the number of bands, but just the size of the city and just the festival life and that sort of thing. And I think there's some similarities. In some ways I think that Athens is like there's something more special about a small college music town, and something even more powerful about a smaller college music town compared to these larger musical cities, whether it's Austin or New York, LA, Nashville, that sort of thing. I mean, that's something that was kind of reflected in some of the interviews that I did with the musicians, because they of course strategically moved to Athens when they could have moved to New York or LA or Nashville or Austin or whatever the case may have been. But there was something, there was like this special pull about that Athens, kind of made it a no-brainer for them to, to decide that they were going to, make that venture there. So I have kind of thought about that, because I do think that there'd be certainly a lot of distinct aspects and just the experience of being a musician in a bigger music city and in a nationally recognized music city would be far different from what these musicians experienced in Athens. So I've thought about that. You know, I certainly have thought about that. You know, I'm also have thought about just the idea of fandom and how that's something that could be interesting to explore as well in terms of just another potentially gendered and social class component of music and music participation. But yeah, I haven't really pursued that line as of yet, but that is always an interesting potential project for the future.
Well, we've come to the time to ask you, since we're out of time, what are you working on now?
Well, right now I'm moving on something far different from music, although I still love music, you know, and I still, you know, at some point imagine that I would like to go back to doing another study of music. But right now I'm starting to collect data on a qualitative project on fatherhood. And really what I have been thinking about, you know, the past couple of days, well, actually the past 2 years or so, because I have a 2-year-old daughter now. So now fatherhood is very much, you know, in my day-to-day life and, you know, one of course, the priorities in my day-to-day life. But I've started just to think more about fatherhood and just the sociology of fatherhood. And there's been great work on fatherhood. But one thing that I think would be interesting to examine, especially where I live, Corpus Christi is in South Texas. And I think it'd be interesting to examine just father's experience, maybe not even life or work family conflict per se, but just work family balance and just the work family kind of divide that that fathers experience. Because of course we certainly hear a lot about that in terms of women's lives and in terms of mom's lives.
Yes, with our late last child,
right?
And the second shift and things like that, but not too much on fatherhood.
Right. So I am interested because you do hear this new rhetoric, and of course we've seen a lot of research lately about this new construction of fatherhood and how a number of fathers are more active and more you know, participate at higher levels today. But just kind of examining how work impacts that, because of course work impacts the family as a whole, and we've seen clearly how it impacts women's lives and mothers' lives. But I'd like to examine how it is that working class, middle class lines of work might differentially influence men's ways that they father and just kind of their constructions of fatherhood. South Texas, there's a diverse population here. There's a lot of Hispanic and Latino families down here. So, so of course it'd be nice to add that to this new project as well, looking not just how social class matters, not just how the workplace context matters, but also how race and ethnicity matter. So yeah, I'm at the beginning stages of this project, but you know, I do think it's important work, and you know, there's a lot of just narratives, and just, you know, the culture of fatherhood is something that that I think would be interesting to examine, just to see how it is that men father and what their experiences in family and work life look like today.
And to see how far we've come from the dichotomy of either being expressive or instrumental in the in the roles that we play. Mm-hmm. Yes, it should be interesting.
Well, thank you. Absolutely.
Well, thank you again for the interview today, and I look forward to working with you in the future on your upcoming work on fatherhood.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you for having me. It was great talking about my book with you. Mm-hmm.